Good afternoon, everyone. It looks like it's 1 o'clock, so let's begin the webinar. I'm Christine Sandy, and I'm the director of the Rural Assistance Center. I'd like to welcome you to our webinar, Improving Access to Oral Healthcare in Rural Communities. We all know that there's a significant need for improved access to oral health services in many rural communities. Our speakers today will share their expertise and experiences with you regarding what makes for successful rural oral health programs. The Norc Walsh Center for Rural Health Analysis and the Rural Assistance Center recently launched an oral health toolkit that can be found on the RAC website, and we'll hear today from one of its creators about how it was developed, what was discovered about best practices in the process, and how you can use the toolkit to implement an oral health program in your community. We're also very excited to hear about the experiences of our two other speakers who will tell us about their successes and their lessons learned in implementing oral health programs in their own rural communities. And now, it is my pleasure to introduce our speakers for today. Our first speaker will be Alicia Bain. Alicia is a senior research scientist with the Norc Walsh Center for Rural Health Analysis. Alicia designs and implements evaluations of community-based public health programs. Her research has focused on public health, rural health, and health policy. Alicia managed the development of the Rural Oral Health Toolkit Project, funded by the Federal Office of Rural Health Policy. She's also developed a toolkit on community health workers and is currently working on a toolkit about care coordination. Bain has a master's degree in public affairs from Princeton University. Next, we will hear from Linda Madicino, the grant project director for the Innis Community Health Center, a federally qualified health center that has primary medical and dental care and a school-based health center. Recently retired from the executive director position of the FQHC, which she held for the last 12 years, she remains committed to the oral health program started in the clinic. She works as a part-time grant director for the Innis program. The Innis FQHC currently has a fixed-based dental clinic as well as a mobile dental clinic. Oral health has been a critical need in this rural community, especially for the children within the area. Our final presenter will be Darcy Zarnak-Lauren, who is the executive director for Thumb Rural Health Network. Darcy has a bachelor's degree from Saginaw Valley State University and has worked in the nonprofit sector for 13 years. Darcy's healthcare career started out as an outreach worker for a HRSA grant-funded program in northern Michigan. In her role leading the Thumb Rural Health Network, Darcy focuses on emerging collaborative opportunities that address the complex health issues of the Thumb region. Services focus on population health and access to health care for the underserved population. That includes emphasis on primary care and dental services, as well as chronic disease management. She also strives to identify and facilitate educational opportunities and leadership development for network members. Additionally, Darcy serves on the executive board of the Board of Directors for the National Cooperative of Health Networks. So now we're ready to hear from our first presenter, Alicia Bain. Alicia?
Thank you, Christine. Good afternoon, and thank you, everyone, for joining the webinar today. I am pleased to be able to introduce the Rural Oral Health Toolkit, which is a project that is funded by the HRSA Federal Office of Rural Health Policy. The Rural Oral Health Toolkit focuses on improving access to oral health care in rural communities. We know the importance of oral health to a person's health and well-being, as well as the range of diseases and disorders that result from poor oral health. But as this grantee on the slide describes in this quote, disparities exist in rural communities on a number of levels, and they can make access to care more difficult. Improving access to oral health care in rural communities is an important and challenging issue and the focus of this toolkit. I'm going to briefly describe the background for our project and give you an overview of the toolkit, and then I'll also describe some of our findings and lessons learned. Then I'm going to turn it over to two grantees that have experienced implementing oral health programs in rural communities and will offer their perspectives. The Rural Health Outreach Tracking and Evaluation Program is funded by the Federal Office of Rural Health Policy, ORHP, within HRSA. And this evaluation is conducted by the NORC Walsh Center for Rural Health Analysis in partnership with the University of Minnesota Rural Health Research Center. NORC and the University of Minnesota are also working with the National Organization of State Offices of Rural Health and the National Rural Health Association to disseminate findings from this evaluation. The Rural Health Outreach and Tracking Evaluation is designed to monitor and evaluate the effectiveness of federal grant programs under the outreach authority of Section 330A of the Public Health Service Act. The Outreach Authority Program was created as part of the Public Health Service Act of 1991, and approximately $500 million have been awarded to rural communities since this program began. This is a little more information about the 330A program. There are nearly 900 consortia projects that have participated. Their goals have been to expand access to care, to coordinate resources, and to improve rural health care service quality. There are 7 different grant programs that operate under the authority of 330A. Through this project, we conduct evaluation activities both within and across the 330A Outreach Authority programs. And because these programs are so diverse, it's not really possible to evaluate all programs with a single approach. Therefore, each year we conduct 4 new evaluation projects. As part of our evaluation, we have developed evidence-based toolkits on different topics. And this toolkit focuses on rural oral health. We have also completed toolkits on community health workers, obesity, mental health, and we're currently working on toolkits on care coordination and health promotion. So why are HRSA and OHP interested in oral health? We know that there are provider shortages in rural areas that make it difficult to recruit and retain dentists. There is a lack of dentists who accept Medicaid or have discounted fee schedules. Geographic isolation can make it difficult for people to get to a dentist. A lack of public transportation is also an access barrier, as well as poverty. While many communities have developed innovative approaches to increasing access to oral health care, there is a lack of research on the oral health models that work best in rural communities. The 330A Outreach Authority grantees have successfully implemented a range of different program models, and their experiences suggest promising practices that can be adopted. This toolkit is an opportunity to share these practices and to disseminate resources and information to other communities. Why are evidence-based practices important? We are developing evidence-based toolkits because it's important to know what works and to invest in programs that do work and will have an impact. Evidence certainly informs the decisions that we make in every step of the planning process for a new program, and it can take multiple forms. Some approaches may be evidence-based because they've been rigorously tested and evaluated in various settings, while others may be promising because they work in a particular community but may not have been rigorously evaluated yet. In many cases, rural programs don't have the resources to conduct an extensive evaluation of their work. However, they're implementing very promising approaches that may offer important guidance to other communities. Therefore, this toolkit is comprised of both evidence-based and promising practices. I just want to acknowledge the project team that created the toolkit and also tell you about our goals for these toolkits. We want to identify models that may benefit grantees, future applicants, and rural communities. We want to document the scope of their use in the field. And then we build an evidence-based model toolkit around topic areas specific to rural health. Our activities have included reviewing grantee applications for a subset of grantees developing rural oral health programs. We also review the literature to identify models that can improve access to care. For this toolkit, we interviewed a subset of grantees who were funded in 2010 to understand their experiences. And then finally, we use the information from the interviews and from the literature to develop a toolkit, which is now available at the Rural Assistance Center website. This is a snapshot of the main page of the toolkit. And as you can see, the toolkit is organized by different modules reflecting different topics. There's a clickable menu to direct you to the topic that interests you. Each topic includes information and resources. Resources may include white papers, websites, templates that you can adapt, curricula for training, and other informational resources. Within these topics, there are also links to other parts of the toolkit where you can find more information. This is just a visual of the organization of the toolkit. And if you scan it, you'll see there are 7 modules, and this is how the content in the toolkit is organized. The first module provides an overview of oral health in rural communities. The second discusses evidence-based and promising oral health program models and ways to adapt these programs to meet your community's needs. Module 3 provides resources and information that support the implementation of oral health program models. Module 4 discusses strategies that could help you to sustain your program. Module 5 is a framework for evaluation and includes methods and considerations and metrics that specifically apply to oral health programs. Module 6 is about disseminating results from your program. And Module 7 provides examples of programs that have been implemented in rural communities. And the idea is that communities can use this toolkit and find information and resources wherever they're at in the planning process, whether it's conceptualizing the program or actually implementing it or perhaps disseminating results. So next, I want to just describe 8 program models that we identified in the literature and in practice. The first is what we're calling the workforce model. And this focuses on recruiting and retaining dentists, as this can be challenging in rural areas. Rural communities have implemented workforce programs that involve encouraging students from rural communities to choose dental careers, offering incentive programs to dental professionals who serve rural populations, introducing students to dentists who practice in rural areas, and also creating linkages between dental schools and dental clinics to increase the number of graduates completing a portion of their training in a rural community. In the mobile dental services model, a mobile dental unit is used to conduct dental exams and also deliver fluoride treatments and sealants and take x-rays. Some mobile programs deliver oral health education services as well. Mobile units may also be used to deliver portable dental equipment to schools or other organizations where dentists can deliver oral health care services. On the next slide, there are 3 additional models. The school-based model is where dental professionals are delivering services to children in school-based clinics. These programs may offer fluoride varnish, sealants, and education to students. And if needed, there are referrals to local dentists that have agreed to treat more complex cases. The school-based model helps to reduce missed school time for children and can help to reach children and families that may not seek dental care due to a lack of resources. The dental home model is a comprehensive approach to improving oral health access by providing a regular source of care. This model emphasizes an ongoing relationship between the dentist and the patient, as well as increased collaboration among providers and the promotion of oral health education. Rural communities are designing dental homes for both adults and children. And then in the oral health primary care integration model, rural oral health programs are improving communication between dental providers and primary care providers. Approaches include establishing referral partnerships between dental clinics and primary care practitioners and creating interdisciplinary teams where dental hygienists work alongside primary care physicians to provide dental services. And then finally, on this last slide, the allied health worker model supports rural oral health programs by providing dental care, education, referrals, screening, and social support services. Some states have established an allied health professional training program for mid-level dental therapists who have more training than a dental hygienist, but less than a dentist. And this approach was designed to increase access to care. The community outreach and engagement model is a model about increasing knowledge and awareness of the importance of oral health. Examples include conducting targeted outreach in hard-to-reach rural areas and providing oral health education at community events. And then finally, the community fluoridation model is a public health intervention to prevent tooth decay. This is a Healthy People 2020 oral health objective. Rural populations are less likely to have access to adequately fluoridated drinking water. We found few rural oral health programs have focused on community water fluoridation because of the challenges associated with changing policy. I just want to note that these models can complement, they definitely complement one another, and they're often implemented together. So programs may implement a school-based model and a mobile dental clinic model together, or community outreach and engagement may be implemented as part of several of these models. So I think it's important to know that even though they're presented separately in the toolkit, there is a lot of blending going on. I also want to present some lessons learned from our experiences developing the toolkit. The first is that partnerships were a critical facilitator of success. Collaboration is the name of the game. The Outreach Authority grantees reported that their programs would not have been successful without a combination of talented staff and expertise and contributions from a range of organizations. Partners donated funding, staff time, technical assistance, space, and supplies. And as you can see, I've listed a number of different partners that commonly work together on rural oral health programs. We found one grantee's partners donated space for a dental clinic. Another grantee's partners financed a mobile dental van. Grantees also worked with their partners to identify champions in the community to help to engage providers, educators, and policymakers to participate in or support their program. Grantees also commented on the importance of publicly acknowledging the contributions of their partners. In terms of challenges, certainly grantees experience challenges. One of the challenges we heard about was identifying a dentist to serve in a dental clinic. Some programs relied on retired volunteer dentists as well as dental students from residency programs. Grantees implementing the mobile dental programs had to establish referral networks with local dentists that could treat more complex cases that could not necessarily be addressed during a mobile unit visit, such as a root canal or surgery. Some grantees also dealt with issues of stigma in their programs. So, for example, in some cases, even though a program was offering services that the community needed, people were reluctant to use them because of issues related to stigma. And then finally, a note on evaluation. Grantees are engaging in evaluation and in all types of evaluation, process, outcome, and impact. But they did find that it was difficult to demonstrate the true impact of their programs in the short term. They have identified many, many promising practices and outcomes. And I'm going to provide our contact information, and I'll stop here and hand it back over to Christine. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much for that information, Alicia. And at this point, I'd just like to remind everyone that you will have the opportunity to submit your questions through the Q&A box on your screen, and we'll address those questions once all speakers have presented. Now here to tell us about her efforts with the Innis Community Health Center is Linda Modestino. Linda?
Thank you. Hello, everyone, and thank you again for the opportunity to just tell our story today. I know all of you that are listening have great stories about the wonderful work you're doing in your communities, and we're just excited to share our story with you today. Let me tell you a little bit about us and who we are as the Innis Community Health Center. And we are, as they said earlier, a federally qualified community health center located in rural Louisiana. We're about 70 miles from Baton Rouge, and we provide care to three rural parishes. We call our counties down here parishes, And mainly the parish that we mostly serve is what they call Point Coupee Parish. And we provide medical and dental and mental health services as an FQHC and school-based health. And then, of course, we have the dental, both fixed-base clinic and the mobile dental unit. Well, we got involved in the oral health grant, trying to move these slides ahead. Is this working? There we go. The next one, please. The initial grant we had was in 2009 to 2011, and we were going to provide that evidence-based fluoride varnish, and we were going to try it on infants and toddlers in a primary care setting and not just leave it, you know, to a dental office kind of thing. And we wanted to do this to improve oral health education in the community and get to our parents on getting these kids early on in life. And so we were going to try this in our medical clinic by our medical providers. And in this grant, we also were going to partner with the LSU School of Dentistry and two other rural FQHCs in South Louisiana. And out of all this, we wanted to increase the preventive dental care and influence dental health habits in children, even early on, and hopefully get children established with a dental medical home. And, of course, us as an FQHC, we had that ability to offer that to our families that were coming in for their primary medical care. And we wanted to improve the primary care provider's oral health assessment during the medical visit. One of our practitioners always told me it's the whole idea of don't take the mouth out of the body or just leave it for the dentist to evaluate, but really to engage in oral health assessment during that medical exam. Well, next, on the next slide, we wanted to provide the fluoride varnish, and in this first year, or this outcomes of this first grant, we did 319 infants and toddlers. We were using the age range from 6 months to 6 years coming in clinic in the primary care setting. And we also did educate our primary care providers, our nurses, nurse practitioners, medical assistants, because we can do that in the state of Louisiana. The medical assistants can learn the technique of the application of fluoride varnish on the children's teeth. So we were able to do that as well as to engage in using that dental caries risk assessment. And the last of the outcomes there was to increase the oral health education with our children and our families during that visit. And we knew that as primary care providers, if we could realize early on issues and influence that and refer early on and get that child established, then we've got a much more promising outlook on that child's oral health as they begin to grow and then go on to school and advance in their years in school. So the lessons we learned was that we thought that the well child visits was the best portal for the access. And we still believe that to a certain extent, but I'll come back to that point in just a minute. But we had to rethink this because we were experiencing, as many of our colleagues were, that we had a high no-show rate in that population. And we saw that early on in the grant period, and we knew that if we didn't sort of course correct at that time, trying to reach out and get more children, then we weren't going to be able to touch that many children. Because what was happening was that during the well child exam, we could do that, but again, the high no-show rate influenced our ability to do that, and then mama was bringing them in for just an episode of care, like a sore throat or a runny nose or something, and she really doesn't want to fool with us doing that varnish on an already sick or kind of cranky child at that time. So really, we were missing out on the opportunity to teach more oral health and to apply the fluoride varnish, because really her goal was just to kind of get in clinic, get treatment, and get out. So we were rethinking how we could reach out and get to this population. And we weren't the only ones experiencing that high rate. It seems pretty characteristic in our well baby visits that we were experiencing sometimes even a greater than a 50 or 60% no-show rate on the well child exams. Other lessons we learned was thinking that, again, that was the best access for a portal. If you'll, when we changed our course and said, gee, and we were learning things in our networking with others, was there another access point that we could get to these children and put on the fluoride varnish and do the preventative dental caries assessment with our kids? And so when we decided that we were going to focus on our Head Start kids, and that'll be in that next slide if you'll advance it, then we could take that school-based health portal to reach out and get more children, because they were our captive audience. They were really the access point that was key to success, since the children were already there. And we could pull them out of the little Head Start class and do the varnish and then, you know, send them back to class again. So we were successful in our first year grant go-around, and we really believed that the school base was the key, and so we had an opportunity then to go into an expansion grant when it was offered through the Office of Rural Health Policy. And so what we did in that second year grant, and that's in the next slide, we expanded the concept of the use of the school-based portal to reach more children. We now expanded the age to go from the little bitty ones, the three-year-olds and that, on up until about age 13. And we also wanted to continue partnering with our FQHCs in the area, or even a little bit further south than us, but we wanted to go after the FQHCs that had school-based clinics within their program of offerings of services. So we said, well, if we could get these children during the comprehensive physical time and complete the dental caries risk assessment and apply the fluoride varnish, we would really be making some headway. And we also wanted to continue our partnering with the LSU School of Dentistry that we did even in grant, in the first grant go-around, because we really connected with them, and Dr. Janice Townsend came down and actually lectured and taught our primary care providers more about the issue of oral health assessments and fluoride varnish as an evidence-based practice. So we wanted to continue that focus in the second grant objectives, and this time we had an opportunity to also partner with the LSU pediatric residents that were in the Baton Rouge area. And we had the chairman of the residency program, who was very interested in oral health. She really liked the idea of what we were doing and was eager for us to get the pediatric residents involved in more of the oral health assessment and the dental caries risk assessment using those tools during those well child visits. So if we could then in those objectives, increase the knowledge base of the primary care providers to other professionals. We also wanted to produce a webinar that was going to be done by Dr. Townsend, and we didn't want to just do that for our own benefit, but we wanted to offer that out into the state to any other providers through the Oral Health Coalition that might want to start to implement this type of program in their settings. So we set out to partner with our Louisiana Primary Care Association, and since they're used to doing webinars and hosting them and people being able to access education through their portals, they were very interested in us having the webinar be produced by them and also being the continuous hosting of that. And Dr. Townsend taught on caries pathology and good oral health and early on detection and issues about referrals so that they could get established with a dental home. So now with this expansion, and now we've got two other FQHCs, one in North Louisiana and one in way South Louisiana with their school-based program, we've got them partnered with us to do it through the school-based health center portal of access. And with the numbers that they're doing in our first year, we've really made some good progress. Our next slide there shows that just in our first year alone, we've been able to hit our mark of 585 total physical visits on this age group that we were focusing on. And we were doing the fluoride varnish applications and our dental caries risk assessment and trying to identify if the child did indeed have a dental home, and if not, refer them to our own FQHC dental services in any of these FQHCs or to a dentist of their liking in the community. But again, as it was stated earlier, it's hard to find dentists that would see these children and for us take Louisiana Medicaid. We also branched out in this year one and conducted our health fairs where we did some dental caries screening and application of the fluoride varnish. And we also have been out with our Head Start and able to get in there because they have routine parent monthly meetings, and we've been able to teach them a little bit more about oral health and hopefully influence maybe other children in the family or even their own. And we've also completed our training with the pediatric residents that Dr. Townsend taught, and that happened back in March. What we're going to, we're continuing to see in the next slide is we've got that webinar up now, and we will be able to provide that to any of you all that want to, you know, go to the LPCA website and listen to that webinar. She makes it quite easy to understand be very easy, I think, even for the medical assistants and other primary care providers to try to listen to and see the advantages of what we were doing. And we've done our meetings with our partners throughout the year and our training. And what we're seeing now as we go into year two is that we think that our opportunity to plan with a Head Start all across our parish. We were only hitting three of the schools with Head Start. Now we have the increase with six. And we're also recognizing that there's some issues with our teachers, and some of those center around just influencing their attitudes about school-based health and the value of the oral health screening time as the child gets pulled out of class. and to value that as much as they do the vision and the hearing. I mean, they wouldn't dare have a child miss those kinds of screenings, but why wouldn't they allow that to happen with the oral health screening? So we've got some opportunities to change some thinking on the part of our teachers. But all in all, we have a very good relationship with our superintendent, with our Fluoride Varnish program in the school-based health center, and have a lot of support with them. And then lastly, I guess I want to say to you all is just keep the faith and persevere. We're going to have our little planning session as we go into year two, and we know that you're out there and you have your challenges ahead just like we do, but just keep persevering in every little bit of impact that you have in the community. You may not see the outcome of it right now, but the child will feel it down the line. So I hope that you've enjoyed the few minutes I've had with you to tell our story, and I know you'll have questions at the end and an opportunity to conference those in. So I'll turn it over now back to Alicia and for her to introduce Darcy and have her spend time with the audience. And thank you all very much.
Thanks so much, Linda. And with that, we'll pass it over to our final speaker, Darcy Zarnik-Lauren. Darcy?
Hi, everyone. I just want to thank you for taking time out of your day. In respect of everybody's time, I'm going to move through some of these slides probably kind of quickly. I talk fast anyway. So just a quick overview of Femoral Health Network. The network seeks to improve comprehensive services and by exploring and facilitating innovative collaborative approaches with and among network members. We are a nonprofit rural health organization. What our aim is to design and implement population health in the neighborhood of the Thumb region that can succeed in any payment system. Our membership is consists of three public health departments, six critical access hospitals, and two tertiary level hospitals. And our support comes through annual membership dues and grants. So, moving on. Michigan's Thumb region, just a little bit about that. It's three counties, Huron, Tuscola, and Sanilac counties, roughly 2,613 square miles. That's about the size of New Hampshire geographically. It's very sparsely populated, rural, agricultural in nature. Most of the manufacturing that existed in the region has left, and you know, within the last couple of decades. So there's poor economy, high poverty rates, some of the worst in Michigan. And while some of Michigan's regions are rebounding, the Thumb kind of has stayed stagnant, and it's even gotten worse in some areas. There's high population out migration. We have about 131,000 people in that three-county region. 53% of the population is aged 19 to 64, so they're considered adults. And that kind of creates a big problem because with Medicaid in the state of Michigan, it's really hard to get coverage or to qualify adults for Medicaid. And then, in fact, in the past year, 17.4% didn't receive the medical care that they needed due to cost because they could not afford it and did not have any insurance. A little bit about access to dental care in the region. As a result of different surveys, focus groups, et cetera, data has showed that access to oral health care for the uninsured is a huge primary focus area, so that's what the network members decided to focus on. In fact, the Thumb region has very few programs that provide service and care for that population. There are no federally qualified health centers. We have no free or low-cost dental clinics. There's not one practicing dentist in the region that will accept an adult Medicaid patient. They see the kids because they get the Delta dental rates as for reimbursement, but the Medicaid rates just aren't high enough, so they don't want to see anybody. And as mentioned before, there's a pretty big provider shortage in the area, too. And as the local economy continues to decline, the magnitude of the problem just continues to grow. So there's the lack of a support system for that population has resulted in huge pressure on hospitals, public health departments, and private practitioners to meet the needs of that population. And the care provided that has been provided has been inefficient, fragmented, and financially burdensome for those patients. So unified effort was required to meet the needs of the low-income uninsured population, especially those adults. So Thumb Rural Health Network applied for a Rural Health Care Services Outreach Grant with three primary focus areas: primary care, dental, and vision services. So what I'm going to talk about today is the dental focus of the programs that we were able to implement through that grant. The objectives of our dental program were to create a region where all people can enjoy good oral health that contributes to leading a healthy, satisfying life, increase access to oral health services for the vulnerable populations, and also create an oral health care home, reduce visits in hospital emergency rooms for preventable dental conditions, to prevent and control oral decay and disease, and to provide leadership at the local level and encourage collaborative initiatives, volunteer dental professionals, you know, those retired professionals, and even ones that are still working that may want to donate some of their time, and increase community support. The network's role in our dental program, we were the grantee and fiscal agent. We staffed the program. The primary role of the Thumb Rural Health Network staff was to coordinate the project, grant management, recruitment and training of additional providers, and identifying additional opportunities for collaboration. We also partnered with existing models and community agencies, including the University of Michigan School of Dentistry, local private dentists, Michigan Community Dental Clinics, and other human service providers who are able to provide assistance to low-income individuals and families in that region. Quick overview of the program. It was just to help meet the oral health needs of adult patients who are low income and uninsured with an income at or below 200% of the federal poverty level. Our partnership included private dentists, local public health departments, U of M School of Dentistry, local community colleges provided dental services that complemented other outreach initiatives in the network's grant program. So we split the dental focus into two components, basically. One was the Thumb Dental Plan, that's what we called it, and the other were free dental clinics. So component one, the Thumb Dental Plan, I like to call this the 50-50 program. Our partners were private local dentists, provided services to the low-income uninsured adult patients. Each patient received an initial visit, x-rays, an exam, and a treatment plan. And all subsequent appointments were charged according to the Delta Dental DPO, which is a reduced fee schedule. The patient, this program was a year. They had to apply every year, basically. And so let's say they applied on August 6th of 2013. They would have until August 6th of 14 to, get the care at that reduced fee schedule. The grant was able to provide 50% match for dental care, up to $500 per year for the patient. So in essence, the patient was getting $1,000 worth of care in a year. They had to pay the other 50%, but it was done at that reduced fee schedule. So I would like to say that it was probably about 40% of what it would typically cost. And there was an annual renewal on that. So that's just a little bit about the what's happening. Sorry about that. That's a little bit about the Thumb Dental Plan. Component two of our dental program were the free dental clinics. These were very popular. We worked with the University of Michigan School of Dentistry through their community outreach program. University dental students were able to come in and work with private local dentists and also with the dental assisting and hygiene students from local community college to kind of get that, that workforce component fulfilled, where they would come and work in a rural area and hopefully want to stay and work there. Again, able to provide services for that low-income, uninsured adult patient population. What we did was we scheduled with University of Michigan one two-day session per month. That was what one clinic consisted of, and a variety of work was performed, and it ranged from exams and cleanings to filling and extractions. The nice thing about this program was there was no cap on services, there was no renewal. Bad thing about it was there was a waiting list. So the quick results for the Sum Dental Plan, we did have 8 participating dental providers. We enrolled 287 patients through the life of the grant, and those were, they were able to renew on an annual basis. 45% of those patients reached the 6-month checkup or cleaning status by the program's end, which is pretty incredible, especially when you can take into consideration that some of those patients hadn't seen a dentist even for a cleaning or a checkup, some of them in 20 years or longer. So results for the free dental clinics in the life of the grant, we kind of started this about halfway through the life of the grant because we had to make some changes due to changes with the adult Medicaid in the state of Michigan as far as dental coverage and things like that. We had 12 clinics. We only had one dental provider that wanted to participate in these free clinics. However, we were able to service 168 patients who received a wide variety of care, and nearly $300,000 in oral health care services were provided in about a year and a half in 12 clinics. So I think that's pretty incredible. You know, just like anything else, there were some significant problems and barriers that we encountered. The overwhelming need for dental care in the Thumb region, I mean, it was huge then and it's huge now, and it's big everywhere, and there just is not enough to offer as far as services, providers, things like that. A continued lack of access to oral health care for the uninsured and adult Medicaid recipients is a significant problem. We had difficulties in getting private dental provider buy-in, recruiting those dentists, and also, you know, once we kind of got their buy-in, getting them to actually participate was kind of difficult. Transportation, I have that listed here because we have problems with no-shows, people, you know, not calling to cancel their appointments, things like that, because they just don't have, they either don't have reliable transportation or they don't have money to put fuel in their vehicles, you know, if they have to travel a significant distance to participate in the program. We had some problem with staffing changes in the network. In fact, the executive director changed positions, so I came into working with this program about just over a year into that grant, so that made things kind of difficult. Changes to the Medicaid Adult Dental Program was something that we experienced. We had, like, as I said before, we had to change some of our grant, and not enough interest by local dentists to host those free clinics. I mean, if we could have at least had one in each county, you can just imagine, you know, we did nearly $300,000 worth of work if with one provider, the change the impact we could have had, and the waiting list to get in those clinics was over 1 year long. So that was a pretty significant barrier as well. And while we did have some barriers, we also had significant successes. The one provider that was sponsoring the free clinics, he is continuing those, and hopefully some of his counterparts will want to do so as well. Some of the private dentists are continuing the low-cost fee structure for the patients that participated in the 50-50 program. The community college dental assisting and hygiene students continue to volunteer at the free clinics, and they are now, through some work that I did with them, conducting oral health screenings at the regional health fairs. And on average, a health fair they get about 500 to 600 participants throughout a day-long health fair. So, you know, they're at least getting some of the screenings, and if somebody has some significant problems, they can do a referral. It would be out of region, but possibly to another free clinic or an FQHC clinic. And something else that came out of this was the creation of the Thumb Area Dental Clinics. It's a nonprofit dental group with some of those dentists that didn't want to participate in our program. They decided they would like to develop a Medicaid dental clinic based on the Michigan Community Dental Clinics model, and what we're doing, I'm providing them some support with just knowledge sharing, best practices, kind of some of the things we're doing with this group that's on the phone today, what worked, what didn't work, things like that. So I know you guys are probably asking, can a similar project be successful in other rural settings? I really think that it can. You know, we've had some pretty good successes with this. The oral health aspect of the program has been very successful, and I think it can be replicated to meet the needs of other rural communities with, you know, high numbers of uninsured residents. The most important thing to remember is communities that have existing oral health resources in place and providers that are willing to set aside competitiveness to work together are very key to making this successful. So for those of you that are in your initial planning stages, you know, kind of think about that when you're putting your plan together. And for those of you that are already working on this, just remember communication is important. You know, let them know what you're doing, what you're planning, and hopefully they'll reciprocate that and be in contact with you and open to collaborative efforts with you. So I'm sure there's probably a lot of questions, and if you're looking for any information, this is my contact information. I'll try to help you as best as I can. And I have one final thought. To keep the lamp burning, we have to keep putting oil in it. Doesn't matter if you're in the initial stages or if you're, you know, at the end of a program, keep up the good work. Just kind of have to roll with the changes, break down barriers, and, you know, all the work we're doing is for a good cause. So keep it up. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Darcy. That brings us to the end of our presentation portion, and we have just a few minutes for some questions. So if you want to enter your questions in that Q&A section, we can try to get to as many of those as we can. So the first question, I believe, is for Linda. It says, with the program course change from the well-child visits to the school-based programs, you've lost the contact with and the chance to educate the parents. How are you addressing that now?
I think what's happening now is because we've expanded the program to beyond age six, we're seeing a difference in the attitudes of the kids when they come back for their physicals. Each year they go, well, are you going to look in my mouth again? Are you going to look at my teeth? They're starting to ask those questions when we are doing the physical again. And so on the older kids, we're making a difference with them on a one-to-one basis. On the little bitty ones, the Head Start, we still have an opportunity to catch up with the parents in those Head Start parent meetings because there's a lot of requirements with the federal program of Head Start that they have parent meetings and that they have to attend. So we get an opportunity there. And we're not stopping what we're doing in medical clinic, but we just don't get the success rate that we get seeing them in school. And they also, in our community, are seeing that the mobile unit has been going to the schools for about 4 years now. So with us going into the school-based health center, doing the physical with the oral health component, and then them seeing the actual dental bus be in there, we think we're kind of hit the kids from all angles. But you're right. I mean, we're not getting the one-on-one with the parents, but we are making a difference in the older kids, 6, 7, 8, 9-year-olds, because they're asking more questions.
Great. Thanks. Another question is, who covers the liability for retired volunteer dentists? And we assume that they have to maintain current licensure, correct?
This is Darcy. You know, I'm going to try to answer that question as best as possible because we did not have anybody actually volunteer. But, yes, they have to maintain their licensure. And I guess it would have to go under, you know, whatever your clinic facility is. If, you know, if you have a standalone clinic, it would have to be covered under your insurance somehow. Or if, you know, somebody's hosting the clinic and they come in to participate in that, they would have to be covered under that somehow. And I know that wasn't a real clear answer, but those are some of the things that I was thinking about when we were trying to recruit some of those volunteers. So.
Great. Darcy, another question for you. How did you get the private dentist to buy in, and was there a particular method you used for that?
Again, it's just, as I mentioned during my presentation, it's just, you know, the openness to communication. What we experienced in our region, there was a lot of, you know, because there's a lot of dentists, and, you know, we're fairly large region, but at the same time, it's pretty small town, so there's a lot of direct compete with one another, and, you know, when we came in with different proposed ideas, those dentists weren't included in the initial planning stages, so it was kind of, they were kind of taken by surprise. It almost felt like they were being attacked, if that sounds right. But, you know, I just, you know, what I did when I came on board as the director of the program was I, you know, set up appointments with each individual dentist, went in, introduced myself, gave the history of, you know, why the grant was written and the things that we wanted to do, and, you know, just made sure that they knew everything was that was happening, that we weren't trying to eventually take patients away from them if we were to ever open a Medicaid clinic, things like that. So just being open, transparent, and communicating is key.
Great. Another question is, currently it seems that you're measuring the number of fluoride treatments, the number of appointments, and the use of a Caries risk assessment tool. What are measures of success that you would use in the future, and how are you intending to track them?
This is Linda. Some of the measures that we're also looking at is the presence or absence of an identified medical home. And again, we're trying to gain that information on our permission slips when those are sent home to the family through the school-based health center. And if we are indeed getting them, say, assigned, if they don't have a dental home, if we're referring them to our own dental programs, and if indeed that appointment was kept. So we're tracking those referrals to know whether we're keeping the appointments for the referral of coming in for some routine cleanings, et cetera. The other way that we can track in our school system is through our mobile dental unit to see if indeed when that unit went to their school, did they then come out and have their regular exams, semi-annual exams and routine cleanings done or sealants put on out there. The other item that we're tracking is, again, some other parameters of, you know, just who are we hitting, male, female, gender, race, et cetera. Those are some of what we call our PIMS data measures. And then the number of comprehensive physicals that we're doing, we match that to see what percentage of those that had the comprehensive physical did indeed have the documented oral health assessment in the EMR. Hope that answers it for you.
Great. We've got a few more questions here. One is for Darcy, in the thumb-free clinics, where were those held? Was it a private office, mobile, or a tech school? And then also, do you have a dental sealant program that travels into school-based health centers?
The free clinics were held at one private provider. He was gracious enough to, you know, open up his clinic for the, you know, those two-day clinics once a month for the dental students to come in and see those patients. You know, we were kind of blessed to have him, that provider, on board because he's very community-minded. You know, he sees the need in the region, and he, you know, just wants to give back as best as possible. We do not have a mobile sealant, if I remember the question correctly. They tried to create a mobile dental program to come into the schools, you know, back some, you know, a few years ago or so, and it was really, it was not welcomed because of the private dentists, you know, so that kind of fizzled out, and, you know, that kind of was another facet of the overwhelming need in our region and, you know, trying to get some of these other these programs created to, you know, take care of the parents, and hopefully if the parents are coming in, they'll bring the kids in. So
great. Looks like another question for you, Darcy.
Okay.
Were the participants in the 50-50 program eligible for coverage under Medicaid, and how did the program compare in costs with Medicaid? And then also, did you encounter any stigma with dental care where folks don't prioritize dental care, and how did they address the stigma?
I'll talk about the Medicaid portion first. No, we did not see anybody that was Medicaid eligible because that's considered coverage, and that was kind of difficult at times because of the what they call the Medicaid spend down, and you know, because if they reached that amount, then they would have the dental coverage as well as primary care coverage, and so those people, you know, those people fell even further through the cracks. But no, we didn't see anybody that had any form of dental coverage. And as far as how it compared to the Medicaid pricing, was that the question?
No,
that's okay. And I can't really tell you exactly how it compared when what the dentist would do was they would charge the Delta Dental DPO rate, which is a reduced rate schedule, and it's like about 40% of what they would typically charge. And the way I used to explain it to an old potential patient was, if you have, you know, $100 worth of care done, you're only going to pay 40% of that, and then, or that's what you will be charged, and then you as a patient is responsible for 50% of that. So, you know, they would be paying $20 for $100 worth of care. And the other question was,
did you encounter any stigma?
Stigma, yes. The nice thing, because yes, as Linda mentioned, there's oftentimes a stigma attached with all kinds of facets of oral health care. You know, if you don't get the care that you need and you have a bad mouth, bad teeth, things like that, it's hard to find employment. People don't seek employment because they're oftentimes embarrassed of that. And as far as going for care, one nice thing about the way our program was set up was these patients got to go into a regular private dental office. They had a private dental home. You know, there was no stigma attached of going to an FGHC clinic, a Medicaid clinic, a low-income clinic, whatever you want to call it. They got to go in just like anybody else. And, you know, any other patient sitting in the waiting room, most of the time they probably weren't even aware that they were participating in a grant-funded low-income program. So that was really nice, and that, I think, encouraged people to start going because, you know, the region is small enough, and, you know, I have gone to the health fairs and things like that, and I've actually got to talk one-on-one with some of these patients who, some of them at the beginning were really reluctant, or they thought, okay, what's the catch? You know, what am I, you know, am I going to be out a bunch of money if I go into this? And then, you know, even seeing them 6 months or a year later, the difference in even, you know, they smile and they just look healthier and they, you know, just so thankful. And I think that's part of it is, you know, there was no stigma attached to this program. They just got to go in like anybody else and nobody knew otherwise.
Great. We've got quite a few more questions, but we'll maybe just do one or two more, and then we'll probably need to wrap it up. To any of you, I guess, what are some best practices to address no-show appointments? I know that's a difficult issue. Now, did you find any best practices in that regard?
This is Darcy. With the 50-50 program, it was, you know, a call, just, you know, just like a reminder appointment. With the free dental clinics, you know, there was a reminder call, but if that patient did not show up or if they called and canceled, the next person on the waiting list was called because that, I mean, you could feel those people would drive, you know, an hour and 15 minutes to come to that clinic. So that was a couple of the things that we did. And something else I didn't mention when I was going through my slides that I wanted to. You know, we partnered with public health departments. They had staff that donated time, you know, as part of their commitment to the grant to, they would enroll the patients for both the facets of the program, and they would sometimes, you know, be come in for other things, you know, WIC programs, breastfeeding programs, things like that. And so the nurses and stuff, it would be in their chart and say, hey, you remember you have to go to the dentist, or, you know, have you been keeping your appointments, things like that.
This is Linda. We oftentimes use those queuing mechanisms in our regular medical clinic to say that it links back over to say that, you know, you've got an upcoming dental appointment. But what we did with our high no-show rate and the well-child visits, we still just send out the reminders to them. We use a little pre-printed postcard about your next visit, because they're on a schedule kind of developmental cycle that it tracks with. But we try to call, but we also know that very few people anymore in this area have landlines, and telephone numbers weren't always good. And the issue for us, a big challenge, is that when they do have a cell phone or whatever, they're a cell phone that may be a throwaway or limited minutes, and we don't always capture that number. So it's very hard, and that's why school-based health care, when they go in at 3 years old into the Head Start program, then at least we're seeing the kids, and we're seeing that in this rural area, as well as in North and South Louisiana, the Head Start programs are full. And at least we get the child from 3 years old on. So, and we routinely schedule those well child visits, those comprehensive physicals.
All right, great. And one question here, it looks like, is probably for Alicia. It says, when discussing the toolkit, one of the models included interdisciplinary teams, which might include hygienists working within primary care. Can you, or do you know of any states that allow that specifically? It says, currently in our state, hygienists must work under some sort of supervision of a dentist, and even public health supervision does not include medical offices as an allowable setting. I'm just curious what states might allow that so we can look at their practice acts.
That's a great question. I actually don't know off the top of my head which states in particular you might be able to reference, but that's certainly something we can look into.
Great.
In Louisiana, the hygienists have to work under the direction of a dentist if they're doing the hygiene, the sealants and the hygiene cleanings. But in terms of the application, for instance, of fluoride varnish, we do have in the Dental Practice Act that the medical providers or nurses or medical assistants can apply that varnish. But I know that's every state is unique.
Right. And this is Darcy. I mentioned the PA 160 program in my presentation. And this public act in Michigan, it allows hygienists to work within a PA 161 program to provide preventative services to the underserved population. And they can do certain things. I want to say sealants is included, like cleanings, x-rays, things like that. And the dentist doesn't have to physically be there for those services, but you do have to have a supervising dentist, if that makes any sense. But basically,
right,
someone who can come in, and it sounds similar to what Linda was talking about.
Yeah, that's the way it is in. They don't have to be on-site, or there's so many days that they can do that, but it can't be on an ongoing basis that the dentist is never there, that he or she has to provide oversight to the treatment plan.
Yep.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for those answers. And I know that there were other questions that we didn't get to. I believe all of the speakers do have their contact information included in the slides that you can download off of the RAC webinar page on the RAC website. So if you have a question for one of the presenters that we didn't get to, I'd encourage you to go ahead and contact them. And if you have any trouble finding that information, please contact RAC, and we can find that information for you. So on behalf of the Rural Assistance Center, I'd like to thank our speakers for the great information and insights that they shared today.